You gotta have soft music when you talk about taking over a country without people knowing. Step one is you get the support of the locals. I'm gonna trade them brass for scarves and whatnot. I figure that will stimulate their economy. They can melt it down and make IEDs out of it. Get rupees from the Pakistanis and brass from us. It'll be good. Good for everyone involved. Step number two, becoming king of Afghanistan, is once we pull out, I'm gonna stay behind. I'm gonna hide in a conspicuous vehicle, something nobody has around here. Maybe a white Toyota Camry wagon. There's not too many of those rolling around here. I'm gonna hide out for a little bit, and then I'm gonna grow a beard out, and I might become supreme overlord of just a province, one province at a time. I might migrate to Pakistan, cross the border a couple times. I don't know yet. But I definitely want to have an army of children, because they frighten me. And I think they're like clowns. They scare people just because they're so innocent.
I get the impression from watching the US soldiers that they seem to be living in a bubble there on the outpost, and I seem to get the impression also that they don't really want to be there either. I see you nodding your head there, Jonathan. Did you get that impression?
Well,
also?
I thought that was one of the best bits of the film, actually, the sort of pointlessness of the American occupation and what the hell they were doing. They didn't know themselves. And then this very naive speech that one of the officers gives to a group of Afghans who sit there completely silent. You know, you can try and read their minds, but they're saying, what is this man talking about? You know, who is he? What right has he got to be standing here? Yeah. So I think that was really great. And then the firing, too, the Americans just blasting away at some hillside. Nobody else in sight. They couldn't see what the so-called enemy was supposed to be.
We have a clip of that, actually. We don't want to give too much away just yet. But
okay,
we won't
spoil the plot. But, you know, the pointlessness of the American occupation.
I suppose that's a symbolic message. And Kaleem, would you agree with that? What did you make of their contribution in this documentary and how they
portrayed? I really like the way that the director made a film about little groups, a little group of kids and then the group of American soldiers, and the juxtaposition between the two of them. So in one scene you're watching this pointlessness, and we bring a lot of baggage to the film of what we think should be happening, and he's just saying it's mindless, but he doesn't really hammer home that point. He's just showing and tell is a good filmmaking technique.
It's a beautiful film indeed. And I just want to move on briefly now to something in the beginning of the film. It's established very on that Afghanistan, through the narration, has been a war-torn country for a long time, and it's been plagued and prone to invasion. Jonathan, if I can ask you, how accurate is this point that the documentary makes?
Well, in modern times, of course, it's been at war since 1979, when the Soviet Union set its troops in there, and really that war has continued until today. But in the medieval period, as they point out, Genghis Khan came, and there was Nasrallah, the king, who was overthrown. But actually, a lot of the kids that we saw were probably the descendants of Genghis Khan, so they are the children of invaders. But this is a country that's at the crossroads of Central Asia, and so it's obviously one that many foreigners have tramped through and tried to conquer. After all, Alexander the Great, the city of Kandahar, which we all know is named after Kandahar, is the corruption of Alexander. Mm-hmm. He founded that city. So there have always been foreigners coming through. But I think the point that ought to be made, and isn't made well enough in the film, is that the civil war is also there. It's not just a question of kind of united Afghans against the foreigner. There's a civil war going on, and really that's what the struggle is now about. There's the Afghan army with the Americans helping them, and then there's the Taliban on the other side, and even the terrible ISIS, IS, has come into Afghanistan recently. Mm-hmm. And so it's partly foreigners coming in and partly Afghans fighting among themselves.
Mm. So it's an incredibly complex issue, Afghanistan, and you can't explain it all in one film. So I suppose, so watching this scene, I was worried that the children might be there in the mountains when they were shooting. But I would like to talk actually a bit more about the children now, since they're such a central part of this film. It seems really young to be dealing with this situation and the gravity of it all. And this film suggests that actually that there's a codependent relationship, I suppose, between the children and the US soldiers, and that they are trading with the leftover ammunition, other equipment and so forth. But then it makes you think, on the other hand, actually, they wouldn't be in the situation if there wasn't an invasion in the first place. Did this message resonate with you also?
I think what resonated more was the actual image of ammunition and how ammunition had become something that it wasn't meant to be. You see the soldiers just shooting into mindlessly, asking if it's an internet game, which is very true. But with the kids, they're bartering with the ammunition. They're also using it to weigh opium at one stage. It's become something that's so everyday, but it's not actually about the ammunition. It's not about the war. It's about this, as you say, codependency. And he shows that in a way without overbearing the point, which I like. But ammunition is a big key part of this film. Mm.
And also, Jonathan, I just want to get your views, actually. What do you make of this sort of fight for survival for these children and the way that they have to depend on these US ammunition to get by?
Well, that's what made me feel, I wasn't sure how realistic it was, really. I mean, these are, let's face it, child soldiers, and it's terrible that children are put in this position. We see nothing about their families, apart from one boy who wants to marry the girl next door, as it were, and has to ask the father, obviously, for permission. But apart from that, there's no sense of families or what the parents think about it. Do the parents want the kids to be doing this? Are these orphans? Where are they living? I mean, so that's why I thought it was over-romantic, you know, seeing these sort of kids being grown-ups already earlier before that time.
Actually, I did some research, and according to the charity Save the Children, nearly a third of all children in Afghanistan are actually unable to attend school, leaving them potentially more vulnerable, at risk of child labour and exploitation and so forth. And there's also the issue of early marriages and sort of, obviously, the drug problem, which is quite prominent in the film.
Well, there's also the unexploded ordnance, you know, the landmines. They're unscrewing that scene. When there's a scene where your boy unscrews a landmine to try and defuse it, to take it off, to be sold. I mean, you know, and the other kids are sitting around within 4 feet of him, so if the thing does blow up, you know, several kids are going to get killed. Mm. I mean, there's a real danger. A lot of children are dying of unexploded ordnance, but more by accident than because they're trying to sell it. You know, they trip on it, they think it's a toy, they pick it up, it blows up in their face. So it is a serious problem.
Mm. So there is obviously a direct connection between sort of the US invasion and foreign intervention and the risk that these children have.
Well, some of these mines, I think, may be left over from the Soviet Union. They look more like Soviet mines to me. Which are used by the Mujahideen and the Taliban as well, because they've got stocks of them. So it goes back before the US occupation to the Soviet occupation. Mm.
And did you want anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, those scenes, because they're actually reenactments. So part of this film is documentary and part of it is reenactment. And I think those films jar, because those scenes, jar, because they are reenactments and we're watching little children act. Mm. And you can see them act sometimes. It doesn't feel as natural as some other bits of the movie.
Now we're just in the final part of the discussion about this film, and I just wanted to ask you, Kaleem, that some of the criticisms of this film is that it doesn't follow a classical narrative structure. But then perhaps one could argue that actually that this reflects a lot of reality, because the war itself didn't have a narrative.
Yeah, I think the film has a lot of vignettes, as I said previously, and it shows the groups, and he wants it to have a documentary feel. In terms of the structure, in terms of, oh, I've just managed to catch this by accident. But he falls down a little bit because he has reenactments, and that jars with that. Mm-hmm. And then also you see scenes like the helicopters flying, and it makes you think of narratives like Apocalypse Now and Platoon, and it takes you away from the documentary feel. Mm-hmm. So I think that, in a little way, which I really liked about it, because it made it feel like a dream, but it moved it to a heightened reality. And I can see why that's a problem for a lot of people.
But perhaps, actually, I was just thinking it will draw in sort of political people and non-political also, in sort of terms of a compromise. But just to talk about more about the politics of the situation, earlier on in the film, actually, also talked about, it mentioned Obama reporting that there'd be 9,800 or so more troops that will remain after 2014, which is when combat operations formally ended. But then in late 2017, President Trump announced that he wanted to send an additional 3,000 troops to the country. I mean, what do you think the plan is for the US in Afghanistan?
Well, if I can just add to one point that was made earlier, I was talking about how the Soviet occupation preceded the Afghan, the American one. That clip we've just seen of the helicopters, the poem that was being said and being sung, was actually Russian. It comes from the Afghansi, as they were called, the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. So it was clever of the director to merge the two, although perhaps he should have explained it a bit more, mm-hmm. that these people were actually singing in Russian.
There's some subliminal messages there. Perhaps.
More messages. We're coming on to what you said. Yes, there are now, today, 14,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and Obama had hoped to bring them out all together by the time he packed up as president a year and a bit ago. So it's an open-ended war. It's a quagmire. It's a pit, you know, in which they've fallen and they can't get out of. Mm-hmm. But the worst thing is really the Afghan troops. I said it was a civil war. The Afghan troops are also fighting. It's not just the Americans. They're losing something like 20 soldiers a day, more than 8,000 a year. If you think that the Americans themselves only lost 2,400 in 15 years, and the Afghans are losing 8,000 a year, the rate of attrition is colossal, which is why there's massive desertion. People don't sign up again, and they try and avoid being conscripted, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
And terrible indeed. I wish we could talk more, actually, because there's just so much to talk about. But actually, I just wanted to get your final thoughts on the film now. Kareem, what's your final thoughts on this documentary, and would you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it, but I would recommend it for kind of the romanticism and poeticness of it, and that is very different to other documentaries on the subject, for its uniqueness, rather than perhaps its political message.
And Jonathan, your final thoughts on the film?
Well, I would agree with that. I think it's a sort of good introduction, you know, get in there. It points to some complex issues in a simplistic way, but it's because it's so romantically filmed and brilliantly filmed, should get people more interested to learn more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests again. And for you, I've been Camilla Shambayati.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I remember there's a story of regularly mentioned where, you know, even if you have a cup of water, and probably very simple for you to think that what's the value of this water if I drink a little bit of it and throw the rest away. But that accumulates, and that could be in the eyes of some, and the story that I'm mentioning is the likes of Imam Khomeini, where he used to have a cup of water in the night time. He used to put the water next to his bedside table, and he used to cover the water with a piece of paper so that he will be able to continue to drink it throughout the night or when he wakes up in the morning, to avoid wasting of something as simple as a cup of water. And therefore, we need to always remember that, you know, there's that common etiquette that must be observed when it does come to something like something as simple as appreciating water and drinking of water. Now, let me read through some of the important points that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli is mentioning here as far as drinking of water. The first thing that he does mention is that the most exceptional way of you being able to drink water is with your own hand. And he mentions a hadith where it says that once you wash your hand, drink from your hand. And this is the hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, where he says, أَغْسِلُوا أَيْدِيَكُمْ ثُمَّ شُرُبُوا فِيهَا. Wash your hands, and then drink from it. فَلَيْسَ مِنْ إِنَاءٍ أَطْيَبَ مِنَ الْيَدِ. And there is nothing, there's no kind of container, there's no kind of vessel, there's no kind of container that is nicer than drinking from your own hand. Then there is the common kind of sunnah of saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, or saying Bismillah, which we've already mentioned when it comes to food, and when you finish you say Alhamdulillah. We know that sometimes, you know, a person might be drinking water in a particular way, and we've mentioned before that the Islamic adab, the Islamic etiquette of drinking water, is not for you to gulp it, but for you to be sucking the water. And let me show you. So you wouldn't be drinking the water like this. So there's a distance between you and, for example, the cup. You would be drinking the water like that. Now the hadith says, and I'm going to read it as well, is that you should be drinking it slowly, slowly. Now the hadith says that don't drink water like an animal. Naha Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he said, don't drink like animals. Drink from your hand, because it is the best container for water. It's the best cup, if we could say, for drinking.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith from the Holy Prophet, Inna ladhi ya'kulu aw yashrab في آنية الفضة. So, you know that it is haram to buy or sell or have containers or utensils made of silver or gold. And it is also forbidden for one to drink or eat from them, whether it be a spoon, whether it be a cup, whether it be a bowl, any kind of utensil, eating or drinking utensil. In Islam, is haram to have, let alone to drink or eat from. And if one was to do so, if one was to eat or drink from an min fi aniyatil fiddati wal dhahabi, innama yujarjiru fi batnihi nara jahannam. In reality, what they are doing is they are bringing forward, or they are consuming the fire of Jahannam. So we understand that there are sunnahs when it comes to eating and drinking, and there are also, of course, the wajib kind of things or the haram kind of things that we need to avoid. Always make sure that you are drinking with your right hand, because the left hand is for other things. Now, here, hadith from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Of course, we know that one of the makruh things is to eat or drink from a broken utensil. To drink from a broken cup is makruh. One hadith says you should not drink from that cracked side. Another hadith says you should throw the utensil away altogether, because it brings about faqr and poverty. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullahi alayhi, he was asked about a utensil. And he said, حَدُّهُ أَنْ لَا تَشْرَبْ مِنْ مَوْضِعِ كَسْرٍ إِنْ كَانَ بِهِ. You shouldn't drink from the place that there's a crack in it. We will continue on in our next episode. وَالْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَالصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَىٰ سَيِّدِنَا مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ الطَّاهِرِينَ.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding their Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Sukaina Taqawi, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Sukaina Taqawi.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for inviting me to this program.
Thank you for coming. We'll go ahead with our question. Inshallah, we'll continue answering our previous question, which was incomplete. We didn't finish answering it. So I'll just repeat the question. My 16-year-old boy has asked me to buy him a motorbike because all his friends have one. A few months ago, he had asked me to buy him a specific mobile just because all his friends had it. I would appreciate if you can give your advice on this. Should we fulfill his demands, keeping in mind that we are not financially strong? You mentioned a few points for us, and you said that the parents have to be very firm when youths make demands like this, and they shouldn't get angry, and they should gradually explain them that they should be happy with what Allah gives them. But before that, we have to understand why they demand these things. And you gave us a few points, which one of them was that it might be because of peer pressure that they demand these things. And the second one could be because of our own upbringing, that we have given them a habit of giving them whatever they want. And the third one could be because they take a few people as role models and they want to follow their footsteps and want to have whatever the other people have. Okay, do you want to continue with the question? Yes.
One thing I mentioned in the previous session was that there are families who can afford, right? There are families who cannot afford.
Okay.
The question of this mother or the father.
Yes.
They say that we cannot afford,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
So we tell parents like these, that who cannot afford.
Okay.
The first thing is that they should choose friends like themselves.
Okay.
Right? They should send their children to a school where students who study in that school are in the same level, have the same financial status
mm-hmm.
as they have, right? Because if they send their child to a school where rich children go, the child will feel deprived.
Yes, true, right? Very true.
And there are those families who can afford. We gave a different solution for them.
All right.
That they have to weigh the pros and cons, that sometimes they have to fulfill the needs of their child. There sometimes they should say, if they should firmly say no to their child.
All right.
The other thing I say that is the reasons I gave.
Yes.
Right? The peer reasons. Pressure. The peer pressure is more on the family which cannot afford.
Okay.
Right? The family which can afford, sometimes, you know, the pressure is not a lot, but the family who cannot afford faces a lot of challenge.
Okay.
Now, the fourth reason as to why our child demands such things, you know, why would my child come and say that I want a mobile which my friend has?
Okay.
I want a motorbike because my friend has it, even I want it.
All right.
It is because...
Before we go into the fourth reason, let's go for a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thank you.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Taqawi, you were going to mention the fourth reason.
Yes, the fourth reason is that the system of ours is full of competition.
All right.
You know, this the sense of competition. It is due to the sense of competition that sometimes our youths, they want things others have because they feel that they are left behind. Mm-hmm. They want to compete with their friends. Because my friend has the latest mobile, even I want that mobile.
All right.
Or I want something better. Because my friend has a motorbike, even I want a motorbike. You know, this is a sense of competition.
Okay.
It can be due to the sense of competition which all of us have.
I guess it's quite common in youth as well.
Yes, it's common even in children. You know, the system in which we are living in is full of competition.
All right.
We train our children in that way.
Mm, that we look train, the other ones doing better, so you have to try.
Even like, you know, when we memorize Quran, we send our children for Quran memorization.
Mm-hmm.
Then we say, you know, my friend has memorized 5 surahs, I've memorized 10.
Okay.
I want to memorize 15 because I want to be
ahead of
my friend. So this competition is there in school. Mm-hmm. It's there in our home between siblings.
All right.
Right? Like the brother will say, because the other sibling has done something, even I want to do it.
Mm.
So the life, the system is full of competition.
Okay.
Everyone wants to be the best.
All right.
Although this is not bad. The competition in itself is not bad.
Okay.
Right? It is good. But we should know in what things we should compete in.
Yes. Right? We should have some priorities.
Priorities, yes.
True, yeah.
Right? And everyone wants to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
Like who doesn't want to be the best? If you give choices to a person, even an adult, right? If you tell her or him to choose between good, better, best, he'll choose the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a natural instinct in everyone that they want to be the best.
All right.
When a husband chooses a wife, he wants the best wife.
Okay.
He wants the best children.
All right.
Right? He chooses the best school for the children. So this is a natural instinct.
Okay.
But there are a few points which we have to bear in mind, that our demands should be according to our capability. Okay. Let me explain, right? For example, a youth in his high school, his IQ is less than 50.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes and says, you know, I want to be a surgeon.
Okay.
By hook or crook, I want to be a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody will laugh at him. They'll say, you know, look at your marks, look at your capability.
Mm.
You don't have the ability to become a doctor. Right, we have to see our capability and accordingly plan, mm-hmm. right? Accordingly decide for our children.
Okay.
And this is how we should teach our children, yes.
Okay, so for this, when you say our demand should be according to our capabilities, you're talking about the children, right?
No, here I'm telling the parents first that they should keep in mind that our demands should be according to our capabilities, right?
So that way the children will learn.
Yes, if the parents know that this is what it has to be, this is the rule, right? They have to teach their children. They have to train their children like that.
Okay.
That they have to teach their children that they should not demand for more than they have.
Okay.
And it is very important, especially when you want to choose a field. You know, when we see youths, when they want to choose a field of studies, they sometimes choose something which they are not able to do.
All right, Sister Taqawi, before we continue the question, let's go for a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and don't go away.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him."
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing.
Right.
Yes, Sister Taqawi, we were talking about the 16-year-old. And you mentioned a few points for us. And the fourth reason that you mentioned was that this system of ours is full of competition and we try to compete with the others to be the best.
Being the best is a natural instinct.
Okay.
We all want to be the best. All right. But we have to see what is best. Okay. When our children want the best, right?
All right.
When our children want to be better than the others,
mm-hmm.
right? This competition in itself is not bad. But we have to see where is perfection.
Okay.
You know, what is best? What do we call best?
All right.
Do these material things give us satisfaction? You know, what is best? What is perfection? The best thing is the one which has the best quality, which does not break,
okay.
which does not deteriorate,
mm-hmm.
which does not spoil, right? Which takes us towards success,
all right? right?
Which gives us happiness,
mm-hmm.
which gives us contentment.
Right.
You know, why does a boy demand a mobile? Because he thinks that will give him happiness.
Mm.
You know, when he shows off in front of his friends, it will give him happiness.
So that's one of the things that we have
yes.
to teach our children,
yeah.
that what is the best? What is actually perfection?
Yes.
What should we go
yes.
after?
It does give happiness, you know, when a child buys a new mobile, or even adults.
But a temporary happiness.
But it does give happiness, but it's temporary.
Yes.
Right? After 6 months, when the mobile starts getting old,
mm.
the color will fade, you know, scratch marks will come on the screen,
mm.
and the child will say, I don't like it anymore. Now I want another mobile.
Yeah.
Right? I want another thing.
Mm.
This happiness is very short. It's temporary.
Mm.
Therefore, you know, this is something parents have to learn themselves. Before they teach their children, parents have to change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In order to teach our children, we have to change.
Exactly.
We have to change the way we think.
Yeah. Right? I guess we expect too much out of our kids when we don't see that
yes,
the mistake is from us.
Yes. The mistake is usually from us because our children are, you know, they become what we make them.
Yes, true.
Right? So we have to teach them that this material world is very limited. It will get over. It will deteriorate.
Yes.
So we have to teach them that where does best lie in?
Mm.
What is there forever?
Yes.
Right? According to the Quran says, فَاسْتَبِقُوا الْخَيْرَاتِ
mm.
Yes, have competition. Quran says, it is good to have competitions, but in good deeds.
True, yes.
Something that will be there forever. This is a very important topic which is discussed in different schools of thoughts, but in very simple language, that we have a body and we have a soul.
Yes.
Right? Our body has needs, our soul has needs.
Mm.
Right? Usually the needs of our bodies are very limited.
Mm.
They get over.
Mm.
They get expired. But we have to fulfill the demands of our soul.
Yeah, which we tend to neglect.
Yes, which will give us happiness. Let me just give you a small example, right,
okay.
to explain that what stays forever.
Okay.
It's the good days. You know, when a lady, she's going to the bazaar, she wants to buy a scarf for herself.
Mm-hmm.
While she's going to the shops, she sees a beggar, a very poor man who is in need of money.
Yes.
She has two ways here. Either she should go and buy the scarf,
okay.
you know, and make herself happy, although temporary happiness,
mm-hmm.
for 6 months. Because after the 6 months, the scarf will become old and she will want another scarf.
Exactly.
Right? Or she should give the money to the poor and she should wear her old scarf.
Okay.
You know, when she chooses to give the money to the poor, the happiness that it will give her, you know,
it's long-lasting.
It's long-lasting, it will be forever.
Yes.
And this happiness is what we have to teach our children to go after.
Oh.
Right? As the Quran says, فَاسْتَبِقُوا الْخَيْرَاتِ
yeah.
Do competition, compete with each other.
Yeah.
But compete in things that will give you happiness, which will give you contentment forever.
Okay, I think this is a very important point that you mentioned.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Sister Sukaina Taqawi, for giving us very beautiful points. Dear audience, if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
it's a complete way.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with the Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
Well, the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. A great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center Twin Buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, emotional, positive emotional image called the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader of chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common, and being, in a way, friends, and affirming a message of which is common to both religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotional and passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe, as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the U.N. body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America's back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962. When the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Ming Aung Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as a Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that looped together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable, and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls